Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. He has traveled the world to bring you the story. Get it first, fast, and unfiltered. Now, this is The Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, we're back. So you probably heard by now that the AA baseball leagues and AAA baseball leagues this year are going to institute a pitch clock. Not a big fan of this. I understand it's an attempt to speed up the game. And I just prefer that Major League Baseball enforce the rules that are already in its books when it comes to hitters having to get in the box and pitchers having to be in the mound and all that. Anyhow, they're going to experiment with a pitch clock at AA and AAA this year. I got some issues about this when it comes to pitchers and pitchers' injuries and guys feeling that they have to pitch if they may not be ready. Gary Allinson's the manager of the Blue Jays AAA affiliate Buffalo Bisons. He'll join us at 11:40 to talk about this. Gary's a former catcher, coach, and manager, so he'll bring a terrific perspective to this particular argument. And in point of fact, as a AAA manager this year, he will be managing games with these new rules in effect. At 11:15, Mark Malone. You know what we think of Mark Malone. He's Westwood One's NFL analyst. He will help us preview Championship Sunday in the NFL. You've got the Seahawks and Packers. That's the game Mark will be working. You've got the Pats and the Colts. Colts, the only team in this tournament or in these finals with a quarterback that doesn't have a Super Bowl ring. That, of course, being Andrew Luck. So we'll talk to Mark Malone about that. Maybe get an update on Aaron Rodgers and his health and what it might mean to the Green Bay Packers if he is hobbled. One thing to be hobbled, I would imagine, against Dallas, another thing against Seattle. But we'll find out from Mark Malone about that. And, of course, the Pats-Colts game, I guess the dominant storyline there is Tom Brady against the aforementioned Andrew Luck of the Colts. The Toronto Raptors have a tough test in their hands tonight, to say the least. The Atlanta Hawks are sort of where the Raptors were at the start of the year. They're in first place in the East. They're second in the NBA. They have a 31-8 mark. They are on an unbelievable roll. They are 24-2 over the last 26 games. They've won 10 games overall and have won a franchise record 10 straight games on the road. The last time they won 10 games overall was October 31st to November 18th, 1997. They won 11 games in a row. So, needless to say, this is a red hot team coming off a 105-91 win over Boston. The game that I guess really caught my eye, there's certainly been a lot of wins here, but on the 11th, Atlanta went into Washington. I'm sorry, Atlanta hosted Washington in Atlanta, beat them 120-89. The Washington Wizards are currently the second team in the East, and the Hawks handed them a 31-point win. They've held opponents to under 100 points five of their last six games, those opponents being the Clippers, Memphis, as I said, Washington, and then the past two games against the Philadelphia 76ers. And the Boston Celtics. It's a team that is at its best, it appears, late in the game. The sixth highest fourth quarter scoring team in the NBA. They're averaging just a shade under 26 points. They've scored at least 25 fourth quarter points 24 times. 12 times. 12 times. They've put up 30 plus quarters. 30 plus fourth quarters. They're fifth in the NBA in fourth quarter field goal percentage. Third in free throw percentage. And, part of that 10-game road winning streak, they are 15-5 overall. And their head coach, Mike Budenholzer, was named the Eastern Conference Coach of the Month for December. The Hawks went 14-2 in December. And maybe more than any other team in the East took advantage of DeMar DeRozan's injury. This is a really, really good team, and it's a good team playing really attractive basketball right now. Dominique Wilkins is an NBA Hall of Famer. He is also the Atlanta Hawks TV analyst. You can follow him on Twitter at DWilkins21. We are very pleased to be joined by the man himself, the great Dominique Wilkins. Dominique, thanks so much for doing this. This team, at the start of the year, when people were looking at the East, obviously they talked about Cleveland. Cleveland had LeBron. They talked about Chicago. They had the veterans, depending on if Derrick Rose would stay healthy, Miami. Obviously, they're a factor there. People talked about Washington, Toronto, and Atlanta. They kind of put them, those three teams, in kind of the next up-and-coming group. What has happened to allow the Hawks to separate themselves from that group?
Well, the thing we have is chemistry. The chemistry, you didn't have guys who've been there more than 3-4 years, and you added a couple pieces. We didn't add many pieces. Mm-hmm. And now that team trusts one another. They don't worry about defensively their man because they know that their teammate's going to have their back. And I think the thing that's the most glaring thing for us is that we defend on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of teams in the league don't, on a consistent basis, defend on the ball. So you don't rely so much on help from your big guys. So it gives the big guys a chance to play a defense without getting in foul trouble a lot of times. So, and that's the difference in the way we move the basketball and having all these shooters. Has given us a major advantage.
When you talk about defending on the ball, how much of that is a product of coaching? How much of it is a product of personnel? I mean, you've got to have the right type of players to do that. But where's the split there, Dominique?
Well, it's definitely coaching, helping you guys to commit to the system. And Dennis Schroeder, Jeff Teague, Tabo Sefolosha, Damari Carroll, them guys are committed to defending on the basketball,
mm-hmm.
and they've done a wonderful job up to this point in the season.
Dominique Wilkins in conversation with us on the Jeff Blair Show. Jeff Teague has, it's funny, we were talking with Brandon Jennings after Detroit was in town here, and he was talking about every team in the NBA now, and Tim Hardaway pointed out them. Take a look at every good team in the NBA. They've all got a point guard. He said they've all got point guards that attack. It's not just a matter of having a quote-unquote good point guard. You've got point guards that attack. What's been the key to Jeff Teague's development and his ability to move into that upper echelon of NBA point guards?
Well, among having great speed, he knows that he is the engine that makes this team run. And so his ability to get the defense back on the heels and attack in the paint, it just opens up those shooters. And he's basically matured into a up-and-coming star point guard in this league. And it took, 4 or 5 years for him to get to this point. But now he realized his advantages, and he has really played it to the role.
You talked about how this team knows each other very well, how this team understands that there are guys that have their back. Atlanta's got assists in 67.8% of their made baskets. That's the best in the league. They're second in the NBA in assists at 25.6 per game. They've had at least 20 assists 36 times. That's not just, as good as Jeff Teague is, that suggests to me that it's not just Jeff Teague, though. That suggests, Dominique, that other players have bought into that philosophy as well.
Well, the whole team has bought into it. These guys move the basketball. I mean, they'll give up a good shot to get a great shot.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Jeff Teague is the guy that that makes all this happen, because he's always attacking. He's always probing, seeing how he can get our shooters involved. And those guys, I mean, they're on both corners and at the top, and you don't know who to guard. You got to take the lesser of two evils with our team, because we got so many guys who can shoot the ball.
As you look around the East right now, does Atlanta have what it takes, Dominique, to sustain this? You know, to be, I'm not saying to be in first place necessarily the rest of the year, but to be in the picture the rest of the year.
This is no fluke with this team. And a lot of people realize, oh, it's the Hawks for real. Well, if you don't think they're for real, man, you're never going to believe it. But this team is a good team. And we, you know, just taking it one game at a time. You know, the thing is, that's not look too far ahead. You know, barring injuries, this Hawks team is going to be right there with the top teams in the NBA.
Dominique Wilkins joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. One of the surprises for the Raptors this year, almost from the start, has been the play of Lou Williams off the bench. He is, of course, a former Hawk. Are you surprised to see the success that Lou is having with Toronto off the bench?
No, not at all. Lou was a very, very good player for us. You know, he was injured a little bit, and so it didn't get a chance to display what he really can do. And I just think at the time, I don't know if the management really gave him a fair shot, you know, and really playing his game. But, you know, sometimes it takes you to go to another team for really to really prosper, and he's done that in Toronto. So, no, I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, it almost seems that sometimes a fresh set of eyes really does make a difference. It's just you see something, you see something in another guy that sometimes it's easy to overlook if you see him in a day-to-day basis, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, and the thing is, Lou's a scorer. And, you know, now he's healthy. He's 100% healthy. So you're getting a full Lou Williams. He was hurt quite a bit with us, and we thought he needed to make a move. And so that's what happened. And he came to Toronto, and that's been their energy and off their bench. I mean, he's a great player. I mean, I love Lou Williams personally.
Dominique, what role has Al Horford played in this team, in this team's run of success right now?
Well, he's the anchor of the team. You know, he's the guy who anchors that defense, the guy who can stretch bigs out on the floor, because a lot of bigs don't want to come out and guard Al Horford, so he makes a lot of guys pay for sitting back in the lane. But he's also is a very good defender. And again, you're talking about buying into the defensive principles that Budenholzer has put in place, and every guy, to a man, has bought into it.
Dominique, it was great to talk to you. A real pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this. We'll see you tonight down at the ACC.
No problem. Take care.
Dominique Wilkins, the one and only. Now, I'm presuming, I don't have to tell you this, but if you do, just check out Dominique Wilkins on YouTube or Twitter. If you haven't already. I mean, if you're, I don't know, if you're like a younger, 12, 13, 14, 15, you're listening. Check this guy out. Yeah, Travis McKenzie, Blake Griffin, but maybe even more Blake Griffin than Blake Griffin. Some outrageous dunks. But yeah, Blake Griffin. And the thing with Dominique, too, is very powerful. Separates him from a lot of guys. A very, very powerful dunker. And I've always thought in kind of an odd way, it seems odd to say that the guy's in the Hall of Fame, but I've always kind of thought he's been a little underappreciated by a lot of basketball people. And I don't know why that is. I just think that it probably the lack of maybe of a championship ring. I don't know. But I've always thought that Dominique kind of doesn't get his just rewards when people sit there and talk about basketball players. And I know it sounds odd to say that about a Hall of Famer, but I've always kind of felt that. It is NFL Championship Weekend, or more particularly NFL Championship Sunday. We have the Seattle Seahawks and the Green Bay Packers, the Indianapolis Colts and the New England Patriots. The Colts with the only quarterback remaining in these four teams that does not have a Super Bowl ring. Mark Malone is Westwood One's NFL analyst. You can follow him on Twitter at Malone's Mike. Mark Malone joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Mark, thanks a lot for doing this.
Jeff, it's my my pleasure. How have you been?
I have been very good. What do you think Andrew Luck's chances are of hanging around for a shot at that ring?
Well, you know, I would never put anything past Andrew Luck. You know, to me, he is the face of the NFL moving forward. I mean, we can talk about Brady, and my vote for MVP this year would go to Aaron Rodgers. I think he's the best quarterback in the league, but he's a little gimpy. But Andrew Luck continues to get a little bit better and a little bit better every week. He's had a problem with throwing the football to the other team on too many occasions, which I think is the only bugaboo. But when you look around at that football team around him, there's not a lot to write home about. You know, Reggie Wayne is a guy that's gotten older. He's playing with a torn tricep. He's lost a step or two. T.Y. Hilton is the only guy that really gets down the football field. And they've got two really good tight ends, but a very average offensive line. Really no running game to speak of, yet he finds ways to keep them in football games and make plays, both in and out of the pocket. So I wouldn't put it behind, put it beyond him, Jeff, but I will say this, that it's going to be really hard to go up to Foxborough and knock off Bill Belichick and Tom Brady and that New England Patriots football team, in my opinion.
Well, and the other thing, too, is Andrew Luck. I mean, he's had problems against Bill Belichick. He's 0-3 in the past three seasons, 8 interceptions. He's been sacked 10 times in those games against the Patriots. What do you think it might be about Belichick's defense? That I don't know if confused is the right word, Mark, but what do you think it might be about that defense that gives Andrew Luck in particular so many problems? Maybe it's just the talent around him.
Well, I think that has something to do with it. I think they've been far too one-dimensional. Again, we talk about the fact that they really haven't had much of a running game. Boone Harris is a guy that's given them a little bit of something. But, again, not a lot of balance in that offense. But, you know, when you look at Bill Belichick's defenses, and Andrew Luck's not the only quarterback to have struggled against them, They're very multiple defense. They'll play 3-4, 4-3. They'll generally speaking, line up with something you haven't seen as a quarterback before. So you've been all week preparing for something, and then all of a sudden you get on the football field and you see something you haven't prepared for. Bill does a great job of attacking and exploiting whatever he believes is your weakness as an offense. And I think over a period of time, that's created problems for a lot of guys, especially young quarterbacks. And then New England's gone out, and they got themselves a couple of pretty good corners in Browner and Revis. And despite some of the injuries they've had, you know, specifically to a guy like Gerard Mayo, they still continue to create problems, especially for passing quarterbacks. You can lock those corners down and get extra people up in the box, and it kind of forces you to be one-dimensional and take your shots against those corners, but they're hard to beat on a consistent basis.
Mark Malone joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. The game you will be working is the Seattle-Green Bay game. You'll be working the sidelines of that game, which I think is, you know, no disrespect to Andrew Luck and Tom Brady, but I think a lot of people are really looking forward to seeing the Packers and the Seahawks go at it. You've been down in the field. How is Aaron Rodgers? What does he have to do to continue to manage his injury, Mark? I guess that's people are going to talk about, can he make the big play, et cetera, et cetera. To me, at this point of the year, if you're a quarterback and you're hurt, it's about managing the injury, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, I mean, he's got a tear. To what extent, I don't think anybody knows outside of that building, but he's got a tear in that calf, and that's going to take probably 6 weeks to heal. So is he a little bit better than he was against Dallas? Perhaps, but not marginally better. I just think that, you know, the big thing is he's going to be, to a certain extent, limited in the pocket. We saw it against Dallas. He was able to move around a little bit to create some time and extend the play. But he does as well as anybody else in the league, in my opinion. He gets out of the pocket and he hurts you with the ball, throwing it down the football field. And he's not going to have that aspect of his game with him against the Seattle Seahawks. So to me, it becomes incumbent on the wide receivers, one, winning quickly at the line of scrimmage, which is quite a chore against those corners in that defense. But you can't expect Aaron to have to hold the football and buy a lot of time. So they've got to win quickly in this game. And I think Eddie Lacy's got to run the ball. To me, you know, we talk so much about this being a passing game. I've always been a proponent of balance in an offense. I want a defense to have to defend all aspects of my offense and all aspects of the field, 53.5 yards wide and 100 yards long. And if you can't do that, then it becomes a lot easier to play defense. So to me, it gets back to the wide receivers winning quickly. Last time they played in the opener in the NFL season on a Thursday night, they did not target Richard Sherman's once in that football game.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a mistake. You basically now ask the Seattle Seahawks to defend one half of the football field. So I think that with the emergence of a guy like Devontae Adams, Richard Rodgers, the rookie tight end, has become a bigger part of the offense. They have more weapons. They can do some things, deploying personnel to create some issues for that Seattle defense and to kind of force Richard Sherman to move around the football field a little bit. But I just think they've got to win quickly at the line of scrimmage.
Yeah, and it's interesting because both of those teams, both of these teams, I should say, they've got four new starters from the teams that played in that opener. And I'll ask you, who do you think is better? Who do you think has improved since that game?
Well, I think when you look at it, and again, the big question mark is Rodgers' calf, but I think that Green Bay is playing a lot better football and are a lot different looking than they were to open up the season. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Seattle, and I think a lot of people downplay the whole Percy Harvin situation, but getting him out of there, I think, has helped that football team. They got off to a 3-3 start, but they faced a lot of really good quarterbacks in the first six games. Since then, although they played very well on the defensive side of the football, they have not faced a top-10 quarterback after week six.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get that in Aaron Rodgers, even despite this injury. So when you just look at the two teams, who's better, and everybody wants to talk about the Seattle defense, and listen, they're as good as it gets in the NFL. I don't know that they face somebody the caliber of an Aaron Rodgers since week six. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they respond to that.
Yeah, and I guess, too, the thing that Seattle, if you're Seattle, I mean, you've led the league in running, I think averaging 172 yards a game.
Yep.
And that's part of the reason I think your defense is having success, isn't it? Because your opponents have had something like what, 77 possessions, I think, including that game against Kansas, going back to Kansas City in Week 11, the defense has allowed just six touchdowns. That's because the offense is grinding it out all the time.
I agree with you 100%. And when you look at the offensive side of the football, there's no wide receivers there that would be more than a second, probably a third on most decent football teams offensively. And that's not taking anything away from the Doug Baldwins and the people on that side of the ball. But that offense is geared around Marshawn Lynch. And to me, it's incumbent on the Seattle Seahawks, in order to win this football game, to probably give him about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 25 carries. He hasn't carried the ball that much, to be honest with you, in the last few weeks. But you've got to minimize that big beast mode run that just energizes that crowd and that football team. And you've got to find a way to minimize it. Now, Green Bay has done some things defensively to help their run game, specifically moving Clay Matthews back to the inside linebacker position. And that's helped them. But they're not what I would call a bunch of trained killers over there on the defensive side of the ball. So they're going to have their hands full. And if they can't find a way to minimize Marshawn Lynch, then I think they're going to have some problems.
Hey, Mark, the big story for us locally here, of course, was Rex Ryan signing with the Buffalo Bills as their head coach, Greg Roman joining him as offensive coordinator. I want to get your take on that signing. How do you think Rex is going to work out in Buffalo?
Well, he's inheriting one of the best defenses in the NFL. That's a good thing because he's a defensive guy. And I like Rex. I think too much bravado sometimes. I listened to his press conference, and I just kind of shook my head a couple of times at some of the things he had to say. And he's never been shy about those kinds of things. But he's a great defensive mind. The knock on Rex is whether or not he's been, A, able to identify offensive talent, and B, develop offensive talent. And particularly at the quarterback position, he went to back-to-back AFC championship games with Mark Sanchez, but they did that predominantly on a defense and a great run game. And he's going to have at least half of that equation when he takes over in Buffalo. The question is, can Greg Roman and that staff develop E.J. Manuel? You've got Sammy Watkins, who's a terrific young wide receiver, and you've got to be able to stockpile that side of the football a little bit more. Because, listen, I think it's great to have great defense and be able to run the football, but in today's game, the way the rule changes have been employed in the National Football League, if you don't have a quarterback and you can't throw the football when you want to throw it, it's pretty hard to win a championship. So when you ask yourself, why does he leave the Jets and stay in the AFC East, you look around and you go, okay, how many more years does Tom Brady have? I don't think he's got more than probably two or three really good years left in him, maximum. So Rex has just got to find a way to develop some offensive talent and a quarterback, and I think if he does that, they've got a chance to be pretty good up in Buffalo.
Hey, Mark, we appreciate you joining us today. Thanks so much. Should be a lot of fun this weekend.
I appreciate it, Jeff. You have a good day.
You too. This is Mark Malone, Westwood One. He will be working the sidelines of the NFC Championship on Sunday, Seattle, as the Seattle Seahawks take on the Green Bay Packers. He is also the host of Under Center with Donovan McNabb and Malone. You can hear that Monday to Fridays from 3 to 7 p.m. on NBC Sports Radio. And as we say, he is our, on a personal level, our favorite NFL guy. So we told you at the top of the hour that Major League Baseball, or I should say baseball in general, has experimented in the Arizona Fall League with a pitching clock, essentially forcing pitchers to throw in a certain period of time. If the pitch isn't off in time, it's called a ball. The batter gets a ball. Got mixed reviews in the Arizona Fall League. I know Dalton Pompey wasn't a big fan of it. Other people, and I find it interesting because I read some articles and it seems as if some hitters had a bigger issue with it, frankly, than pitchers, which I found kind of interesting. And frankly, some catchers had a real problem with it. Gary Allinson is manager of the Blue Jays AAA affiliate, the Buffalo Bisons. The pitch clock will be in effect this year on all AA and AAA games. How will this affect gameplay as a whole? And most importantly, how will it affect pitching? Gary Allinson's a former catcher. He's a longtime coach and manager. Gary Allinson will join the Jeff Blair Show when we return on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, don't forget, Hockey Central at noon is just around the corner. Hockey Central at noon will be on at noon today for one time only. Just kidding. Then it'll be time for Tim and Sid and then Primetime Sports with Bob McCown. It being Friday, of course, there will be a round table. I have no idea who's on the round table at this particular time. But I do know that McCown will be hosting it. So, they haven't decided yet how much time they're going to give guys to pitch between pitches in AAA and AA. That hasn't been decided yet, but Major League Baseball at owners' meetings in Paradise Valley, Arizona, Major League Baseball announced on Thursday that a pitch clock will be used at the AA and AAA level this year. It was used in the Arizona Fall League this past fall, and that's the Arizona Fall League is a league where generally the top prospects in the game compete after the end of their seasons. Baseball used it on an experimental basis in the Arizona Fall League. In the Fall League experiment, pitchers were given 12 seconds with no runners on base to throw a pitch. They had to throw a pitch within 20 seconds when a base was occupied. There was a strict maximum imposed, 2 minutes and 5 seconds between innings and 2 minutes and 30 seconds for a pitching change. And additionally, hitters were required to have 1 foot in the batter's box at all time. I mean, a lot of this is just baseball deciding that it's going to enforce pre-existing rules. Rules that have just kind of, you know, been fudged. It's like the batter's box itself, right? What's the first thing that happens when the game starts? First batter digs in and completely wipes out the chalk marking the outline of the batter's box. First thing that happens. There's no indication yet when or even if it'll be the pitch clock will be in Major League Baseball. Although I had someone tell me the other day that unless it's a complete and total failure at the AA and AAA level, it will be in effect for next season. Something that has to be negotiated with, I'm sorry, not this upcoming season, the 2016 season. It's something that needs to be negotiated with the Players Association. But, I mean, make no mistake, guidelines to speed up the game are, they're coming. I don't know how I feel about it. We're going to be joined in a few minutes by Gary Allinson, manager of the AAA Buffalo Bisons. But this year, one of the players in the Arizona Fall League who received firsthand experience with the new pace of game rules, the new pace of game measures that were put in place, was Dalton Pompey, of course, the local kid who's now the starting center fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays. This is what Dalton Pompey had to say about the pace of game regulations when we talked to him on December 4th.
I know most of the players didn't really like it. They felt like it was distracting. For me, it felt like, you know, you couldn't really get into a routine. You always had to keep your foot in the box. Guys like that time, you know, step out, take a breath or whatnot. And you couldn't really do that. So that kind of hurt. You know, like me as a player, you know, I can't really get into my routine and whatnot. And then I know the pitchers got distracted by it too because they felt pressure to, you know, throw pitches even though they weren't ready to, or there was some sort of rule where you could just step off and throw it to a base and then the clock automatically restarts. So you'd see, you know, pitchers get to down to the 3-2-1. And they would just step off and just throw it to a base, so they could reset the clock and not get a ball on them. So I didn't really like it that much.
That's Toronto Blue Jays prospect. He's now the starting center fielder, Dalton Pompey, talking about his experience with the pace of game rules that Major League Baseball enforced in the Arizona Fall League this year. Again, pitchers were given 12 seconds to throw with no runners in base. They were given a 20-second limit when a base was occupied. There was a maximum of 2 minutes and 5 seconds between innings, 2 minute and 30-second limit for pitching change. I've got no problem with either of those things. Hitters were required to have 1 foot in the batter's box at all time. I have no problem with that necessarily. I don't know about the pitch clock, though. I really don't. I kind of have a problem with that. This year, a pitch clock will be in effect at all AA and AAA games. No indication yet as to how much time pitchers will actually be given. But I don't know how I feel about this. I'm a little uncomfortable with it. Gary Allinson is the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate, the Buffalo Bisons. He's going to be dealing with this pitch clock, and Gary Allinson joins the Jeff Blair Show. Gary, thanks a lot for doing this. How do you feel about a pitch clock?
Honestly, how I feel about it, I'm not real happy about it, but we'll have to play by the rules. You know, and it takes me back, and I heard Dalton there, and when I got the text yesterday about this, that's the first I'd heard of it. I didn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were instituting it in AA and AAA, so I got on one of the articles on ESPN, and it actually showed a pitcher going to the stretch, stepping off. And the announcer said, well, that'll restart the clock. And then the umpire called time and called a ball on him. So, you know, my question is, will this go on through the whole game? I mean, you know, the scenario is the base is loaded. Two outs, full count, tie game, bottom of the ninth inning, and the umpire calls ball four without a pitch being thrown.
Mm-hmm.
And the game's over. In 2005, they come up with a rule of the umpire had authority to tell the batter to get in the batter's box. If he didn't get in the batter's box when he was told to, the umpire could call a strike on him. Well, I'm managing the Marlins Double A club, and we're down in Jacksonville playing the Dodgers Double A club. As a matter of fact, Russell Martin's the catcher on the team. And, you know, it's two teams vying for first place. You know, I'm sure it was August. It was late. We had a double. It was the first game of a doubleheader. We had just taken a one-run lead with two outs. It was a go-ahead run on second base, and they had a left-handed reliever, a kid from, I think, Taiwan, that threw very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So my hitter takes a called strike for the first strike that, you know, it looks like it's ankle high, so he gets out of the box. He's saying something to the umpire. I'm coaching third. I see the umpire points the batter's box, and my first thought was, well, he's going to call a strike on him here because he's not in the batter's box. So he does that, makes the count 0-2, and before I could get to my hitter, he had thrown him out of the game, and then I got thrown out of the game and had to set a pitch hitter up there. He made the last out. And in the bottom of the sixth inning, I believe there's one out at the time. They had the time run on second base, and the hitter for Jacksonville took a borderline, a high, looked like a high pitch. I was in the clubhouse with the kid that got thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
The game was on a simulcast. The ball looked high. The umpire called strike two. Well, the batter had flipped his bat towards the third base dugout. He was a left-handed hitter. Called strike two on him, so he walked behind the umpire, and then he's walking back. I said to the kid that got thrown out, I go, he better get that batter's box, or he's going to call her a strike, which he did. He ended up calling a called third strike on the hitter before he was in the batter's box, which gave us a second out. And the play-by-play guy, you could hear the Jacksonville play-by-play guy on the radio, and he didn't know what was going on, nor did the fans. Well, I called the president of the league up the next day, a guy named Don Mincher, who played in the big leagues about 12 years. And I basically told him what happened. And, you know, he said, you know what, I told his umpires not to do that. You know, first off, there's way too many other things for me that you can do to speed the game up. The in-between inning stuff that goes on takes a little bit long sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Arizona Fall League twice. There's maybe 30 people in the stands. There's no in-between inning stuff, and it's real easy to start an inning in 2:05.
Mm-hmm.
But now you get to games where it's fireworks night, or you know every ballpark has
sure.
stuff where they do stuff in between innings. That takes too long. They can get rid of the walk-up song
mm-hmm.
because too many guys wait in the on-deck circle till that song starts so they can hear that song as you're walking up. Eliminate that thing there. A batter gets a hit. There's a nice play. Everybody stops to look at the replay on the board. That's probably more so AAA than AA there. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the stuff where you don't step out of the batter's box, sometimes as a hitter, you got to get out of the batter's box and clear your thoughts.
Right.
You have a bad call, you know, that you think is a bad call on there that gets you to hole. You got to get out. Calm yourself down, then get back in the batter's box. You know, for me, you're talking about, you know, speeding the game up 2 minutes through the course of a game. You know, some pitchers are pretty good getting throwing it. Other guys are really deliberate. And I think some of those guys are just, they're few and far between. And the last thing I was thinking of was, you know, we lost a game last year trying to walk somebody intentionally. The year before when I managed New Hampshire, we lost a game in extra inning trying to walk somebody intentionally through a wild pitch. So if I want to walk somebody intentionally, I'll just tell my pitcher to stand there for 80 seconds and put him on base. It eliminates the
yeah.
bad toss on an intentional walk.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, Gary, we're joined by Gary Allinson, manager of the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate in Buffalo. My concern, and maybe this is misplaced, but I've got to tell you, I'm worried about a double A pitcher who's, you know, in a pretty pressurized situation, and he's on the mound and it's late in the game and he's kind of worried about the clock and a guy in third, and he delivers a pitch when he's not ready and he hurts himself. Right. That's what I'm worried about too.
Yeah, see, that's one of my pet peeves there. And as being a former catcher, back when we didn't play long games, when there wasn't that many people in the stands and there weren't in-between inning stuff. And, you know, say we had a long inning. We scored 5 runs. They changed pitchers. The inning took 25 minutes. You've got Stroman that's been sitting in the dugout for 25 minutes. As a catcher, I always say, hey, my pitcher probably needs a few extra. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, some umpires have get it and some don't because you're so into the, got to start the inning now. And now you don't let a pitcher get ready, giving him a few extra pitches to make sure he's loose. Then what happens inevitably is he walks the first hitter, and the inning takes longer anyway. So, you know, there's gray areas. You know, you got to use common sense and go from there. And some of these guys don't have that.
Gary, listen, we really appreciate you joining us today to walk us through this and talk about it. It's great insight, and I mean, for what it's worth, I feel the same way about a lot of things. Like, I understand you want to speed the game up for TV and all that, but, you know, the game's the game for a variety of reasons. And if you want to cut down between innings, that's fine. But I'm not a big fan of putting the pitch clock on. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully, my concern is nobody gets hurt. That's all.
Exactly. Look, there's more teams nowadays than there was when I played.
Yeah.
Which means there's more pitchers. Which means there's more pitchers.
Yeah.
And some pitchers' command's not as good as they were back in the day there. And if you can get guys to throw strikes more early in the count, guys swing and it puts the ball in play and the game speeds up. So
yeah, it's perfect.
There's other ways to get back this.
Good to talk to you, Gary. See you down in Florida.
All right, Jeff. Talk to you.
It's Gary Allinson, manager of the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate, the Buffalo Bisons. And great insight as a former catcher, current manager, longtime coach and player about the whole notion of the pitch clock. I'm not a fan of it. I don't think it'll work in the majors. That's it for the Jeff Blair Show. We'll be back on Monday. Hockey Central is next, followed by Tim and Sid, and then Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan. You guys have a great weekend.